This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Alex Scales.
Now, look, I'll confess, I watch quite a lot of breakfast telly in the morning, and I shout at breakfast telly quite a lot because there are certain language that they use which really annoys me. My number one pet hate, how does this float with all of you, is the word iconic. Somebody is iconic. A moment is iconic. Where does that come from?
Not from me.
The word I hate, hero.
Hero.
Is your dad a hero? Is the person down the road a hero? Anybody can be a hero, and we're all heroic.
Okay, this is good. We're talking tabloid television cliches here, aren't we? And lastly, and this is the one where it hooks into where we're going today with the person that we've got as our guest, is that I do feel also that we're verging on the moment when the word disaster falls into this category. It is used for absolutely everything.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a child's bike being stolen or it's a huge human tragedy, all of these can be called disasters in some way. And that worries me a bit. There's a very specific definition of disaster, which is anchored in size, scale, and therefore response. What do we all feel?
It's different for different people, isn't it? You know, because you can have an individual disaster, which will fundamentally change your life. Whereas we can have, as we've seen with the floods recently, a disaster that attract whole villages, whole streets, and needs instant help. So I think it is a challenge of a word.
I think there's a risk that people get desensitized by hearing some of these superlatives all the time and don't always have the inclination to dig a little deeper to actually find out whether it is a true disaster or crisis or whether just the word being used inappropriately to drive an emotional response.
I think it's a shame that, like you say, everything, David, is a disaster. Whereas for me, there are natural disasters, there are mudslides, there are floods, there are fires, and of course, wars. It is about the possibility of recovery. And one of the real difficulties nowadays is it even possible to recover?
At the time of this recording, we are coming out of a lockdown. We've all, in our way, have had to cope with what would probably be defined as a trauma on some scale. And whether we call coronavirus a disaster, you know, is something which is probably a bit of a moot point. But it does bring forward that idea that it's a disaster. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters?
I was thinking more the Red Cross, Keith. The British Red Cross is the subject of our conversation today. It is the British arm of the world's largest humanitarian network, the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement. And British Red Cross is one of the UK's largest charities. They have an income of around 245 million and have been clearly very much on the front line when it comes to the response to coronavirus and the effect that that's had on communities around the UK. We're going to be hearing a lot about that and a lot about the challenges ahead from Mike Adamson, who's the current chief exec of the British Red Cross, who is our guest today. Issues that we think might be coming up. Camilla.
If you look at their accounts, the spend is higher than the income. So where is the income coming from? Is there going to be compassion fatigue on top of economic fatigue and economic problems that people are going to have? So where is the income going to be coming from for the next disaster and for the recovery period?
Keith?
It's a huge charity, and I wonder how they're going to change their objectives or how they deliver their services going forward because of the pandemic. I, like Camilla, I mean, they've got a lot of money coming in, and we've got this whole issue about this government at the moment stopping overseas funding. If you watch afternoon telly, not that I'm a lover of it, the adverts that are coming out again now from all the big charities, they're all saying, please help us.
Alex?
I'm really interested in learning from Mike what it's been like leading an organisation through this period of unprecedented uncertainty. You know, what they're going to keep and what they're going to throw away at the end of the pandemic and how they're going to revert back to how they were perhaps before.
And how they relate to the international arm, to the rest of the Federation, and whether, you know, charity begins at home or whether you say, well, we have a certain percentage that always goes beyond our borders.
Okay, it should be a fascinating conversation. Let's get Mike in. Mike Adamson became chief executive of the British Red Cross in October 2014. He oversees almost 4,000 staff, over 18,000 volunteers, ensuring that British Red Cross is delivering maximum impact for people in crisis. Now, Mike, you perhaps didn't quite anticipate during your period as chief executive that you'd have to deal with a monumental crisis on a fairly local level. Give us a quick sense of how British Red Cross has been involved in the response to COVID-19.
Well, thanks, David. Lovely to be here. This is an emergency very unlike other emergencies because of the way in which it affects everyone. So we've built on our long-standing capabilities in terms of supporting the NHS, helping people to get out of hospital and be supported at home, because obviously clearing beds was a really important part of making way for people with coronavirus. And then we've amplified that and moved into vaccine support and so on. But we've also gone back to things that we've not done for many years, reflecting the quadrupling of the demand on food banks. We've been doing food deliveries, helping people pick up prescriptions. We've created a hardship fund, which gives people with no income and no savings and no recourse to public funds £120 a month for 3 months. And that's targeted at some of the most vulnerable people. And then our national support line, which we've created from scratch, is taking hundreds of calls a week, supporting people with real mental health pressures and some people, you know, on the brink of taking their own life. Again, some of the stories when I talk to our frontline volunteers doing those things, just really heartbreaking, actually. And what we've tried to do throughout is to not only do things as the British Red Cross, but also to do it with others. So the hardship fund is enabled by the partnerships with other referrers, but also we've co-chaired the establishment of the Volunteering Community Sector Emergency Partnership, which is made up of 30 to 40 national organisations and close to 200 local organisations, to broker support into the places where it's most needed. One of the challenges in all the emergency work we do, both domestically and internationally, it's like a juggernaut comes along, but actually people get missed, and it's the people who most need help, the most marginalised and vulnerable, people from BAME backgrounds, but also disabled people and people with mental health issues. People are very isolated and lonely.
We're recording this conversation 12 months on from the moment that COVID-19 became a part of everyone's lives, when the country became locked down. When you look back on that period, those weeks, is there a point where you can say that is when we really realised we had to step up?
I think we realised that pretty early on, to be honest, David, because you could just see the numbers of people being affected and the way it came to dominate the news. You could see the pressures on the NHS building. And so we just grew with it. And you know, what we've also been trying to build in from the beginning is the use of evidence and data to inform where we work. So we know about, you know, what percentage of calls, for example, into the national support line are coming from the most vulnerable parts of the country. We created a vulnerability index that combined vulnerability to COVID, but also economic vulnerability, digital exclusion, so on. So I know that between 30 and 50% of the support of the cash hardship fund has gone to people from BAME communities. We're trying to steer our national resources to the places and people where they are most needed.
Last year, Mike, you were 150 years old, and you were probably, previous to last year, planning your 150th celebration. I guess there are two questions here. One is, what did you think before COVID? And how do you plan for something that you cannot anticipate and have to respond to in the way that British Red Cross does?
Well, you're quite right, Camilla. We were planning a blockbuster of a celebration.
Yep.
So we had to go online and do a lot of it virtually. We were still able to do some things that were really important to us, like our Miles for Refugee program. But then we've had to, you know, really adapt. So we launched a new strategy called Strategy 2030 to look at our next 10 years that was approved at the end of 2019. And what's been interesting about COVID is it's accelerated all of it.
Right.
In terms of reaching into areas of health inequality, the use of digital tools to communicate and engage with people, using data and evidence, creating new cash capabilities. These were all in the strategy. Becoming a greener organisation because we've not been able to travel anywhere. All of these things have been accelerated by COVID.
Your strategy has these three strands to it. One is about disaster and emergency, one is about recovery. And the third strategy, which is really what you've just been talking about and what interests me, is this business of healthcare inequalities. Now, why would an organization that in many people's minds deals with flood and disaster and war look at health inequalities? And when did you decide to do that? Was that very much pre-COVID?
Yes, it was very much pre-COVID. And you're quite right. It's three big causes: people in emergencies, people who are displaced, refugees and asylum seekers, and people who've been trafficked, and then people falling between the gaps in our health and social care system in the areas of greatest health inequality. And that is because we recognised, you know, what's been writ large by COVID, which is a difference in life expectancy across different parts of the country of 10 to 15 years. I mean, it's outrageous, really, when you think about a country that has a national health service. And that we have a long tradition of supporting people in individual crises, as well as the big events like floods or fire. And a lot of that individual crisis work has been in support of the health service around helping prevent admissions for people referred to as high-intensity users, who are people who turn up in an A&E department many, many times a year. And of course, they don't need an A&E doctor. Actually, what they need is someone to get alongside them to understand the combination of social, mental health, drug and alcohol issues that they may be facing.
Yeah.
That is, obviously helps them, but it also helps the NHS because it reduces pressures on the NHS. So it's a win-win. And those capabilities are then really important when the big events happen as well, in the floods and the fires. And for example, the Grenfell Tower fire, where again, you had some people in one of the richest boroughs in London, but actually also with some of the poorest people in London, all living cheek by jowl. And some of those skills are very relevant when you're dealing with the big events as well.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you were talking about that you have indicated where there are local areas of challenge. It might sound like a harsh question. So what? Does that mean other organisations, the government, now can pick up on that and do something? Or is there the possibility that someone will hold this to say, we all need to do something about this?
I think it's both.
Right.
We may be seen as one of the largest voluntary organisations in the country, and we are.
Yeah.
But we are tiny in relation to the scale of need that there is.
Yeah.
And because we work in the spaces where markets fail, there is no prospect of us growing our income to the scale necessary to respond. One of our most important corporate partners, have been fantastic through COVID, is Tesco. Our turnover is 0.5% of the turnover of Tesco. So the only way in which we can grow our impact is through the work we do on the ground, how we collaborate with others. And then the third thing is around influencing and advocacy. So we're taking a system approach to how we achieve impact that is not just based on the operational footprint of the British Red Cross. It is based on how we work with others to enhance overall impact.
You talked about funding. Do you see a challenge going forward for you and other big charities now, as well as the smaller charities?
You know, last year we had to close our shops, our first aid training, social enterprise, some of our community fundraising activities. And we took obviously a big hit from doing that. But we are also, you know, we're a destination charity when people want to give in an emergency. And so we were able to offset that in 2020. The challenge, though, is 2021 and 22, because there are structural changes taking place in the fundraising market that means our general funds income is declining. And so we're looking at a very significant deficit in 2021 and 2022. And that will necessitate, you know, significant organisational redesign, a lot of which will make us better anyway, but will be in order to live within a smaller financial envelope.
Yeah.
Do you then, Mike, say, well, okay, income is shrinking, prospects of post-COVID recovery are lengthening, let's say. So what we will do is we will close our borders. I mean, this is something that I think the government is sort of looking towards, as it were. So do we say we will prioritize within our geographical borders? How will you prioritize going forward?
As the British Red Cross, we have two charitable purposes: to support the most vulnerable people in the UK and to play our part as the part of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement supporting people around the world. And that's what we've been doing throughout COVID, and that's what we'll continue to do. We do use some of our funding, both the general funds and the restricted funds, to support our international work. And they're equally important. It's, you know, it's a very special thing for us to be a member of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, with 192 Red Cross and Red Crescent societies around the world, 13 million volunteers around the world, all of whom are involved in some way in responding to COVID. You know, the government at the moment is both talking one narrative about global Britain.
Yes.
But there is a risk that it appears in other things, approaches that it's taking, to be, as you say, pulling up the borders.
Yep.
And that's not good. And part of our role is to influence government about their own narrative. And we're privileged to have good relationships with government, but it doesn't mean we always agree.
We were talking to Danny Kruger about the report that he did, and that sense that government is acting much more fleet of foot, demand is being identified that much sooner. Is that the sense that you've been getting, and that government is a more of a listening ear now?
I'm not sure it is, actually, to be honest, David. I think government has struggled through this pandemic, hasn't it? I mean, it's done an amazing job on vaccine, and it's done, you know, I think a pretty good job on economic support through the furlough scheme. But in terms of overall coherence, I think it's been pretty challenging for it. And it probably would have been for any government. And that's made it very difficult, you know, for us. My ambition was to effectively join the government strategic coordination group for the pandemic response to help bridge not only the Red Cross, but the voluntary community sector emergency partnership in to those key discussions where we would share information about what's happening locally and nationally, and therefore be able to better play our part as a sector in responding. It's not been possible to do that. What's really encouraging to me is that as we kind of come out, we hope, of the intensity of the COVID response, senior officials are showing a willingness to engage with us now about some of the future and how that could be and how we design that together. And long may it last, but then we've also got to engage ministers as well. And there's got to be some overall coherence to government strategy for recovery.
Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Victims is with us as well. Alex, you must be hearing a lot of these sort of conversations about the next phase and what that involves.
No, absolutely. And I just wonder, Mike, what your thoughts are in terms of how can the sector create a much stronger voice to ensure that it really is playing its right part in these conversations with government?
I don't think we're getting it right at the moment. My own view is that we have to be propositional rather than oppositional. You know, we have the government we have. It doesn't mean we have to agree with them on everything, but we have to find ways to engage them with propositions based on the insights we have from the evidence we've generated from the work that we do on the ground. And I think that we shouldn't be shrill in the way in which we do that. And we've got to come together. And part of the vision of the Emergency Partnership was about connecting national and local organisations in a way that's not been done before. But it's also about making it easier for government at local and national level to engage with us. Because if you think about it from their perspective, we look like a pretty messy sector. And of course, we see virtue and creativity in that. But it also makes it harder for government to see us as serious partners on some of these critical issues. Because who should they talk to?
Camilla?
Can I go back to the disaster point, Mike? It seems to me that we are almost never, and I don't think this is just because of COVID, going to be, as it were, free of disaster. You will then have refugees, but refugees can't always move on, end up in refugee camps. We now have COVID. We've had it for a year. We don't know where it's going to go. How does the British Red Cross decide when something is finished?
Yeah, I mean, the average length of time someone's a refugee now is over 10 years. Yeah. And it's almost a generation. So our job is to support people in the response and recovery from whatever has happened. And so our support, if you take a refugee camp example, would continue after the immediate surge, and so long as we have the resources to do it. One of the big challenges from COVID is to separate out what is chronic vulnerability from the exacerbation of that. What's also happened in COVID, which makes it even more complex, is the newly vulnerable, which by some estimates are close to 2 million people who've never asked or sought support before, you know, be it for economic distress or mental health distress. And many of them didn't know where to go for help. And one of the challenges for our hardship fund and cash support, for example, is the money will run out. We've had very generous corporate support for
indeed.
That.
Indeed.
But the money will run out, but people's economic vulnerability will continue.
You're listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our guest today is the Chief Executive of the British Red Cross, Mike Adamson. One thing I did want to ask you, Mike, is that in the midst of this extraordinary year, there were also international disasters. I'm thinking particularly of the horrific explosion in Beirut, which I know that the British Red Cross were involved in the appeal for that. Do you worry a little bit that this year of COVID, year and whatever it's going to be of COVID, that charity will be about home communities, about domestic need, and the international dimension might get lost given the government reduction of funding in that area as well?
I think the honest answer is, David, it's too early to say yet. What you can see from the response, in fact, to our Beirut port explosion appeal, that actually people were incredibly generous. In total, we raised over £6 million to support the work of the Lebanese Red Cross. Immigration is clearly a toxic issue, but our Miles for Refugee programme of fundraising, you know, doubled in size during the course of 2020. And it shows that if you put the right proposition to the right people, they will respond. I think there's also one other world event in the course of 2020 that's really influenced us, and I think is so important for the sector. And that, of course, was the death of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and the profile that gave to inclusion and diversity and then anti-racism. Because I think that also has raised awareness in a way that would never have happened otherwise and which we must all respond to. And that's why, you know, we've just shared our anti-racism strategy publicly. And we know that we're not where we want to be a fully inclusive organisation, but we have an ambition to get there. And I think that it's really important to acknowledge that as a catalyst for change in our sector as well.
Yeah. I'm going to put a very difficult question to you right at the end, Mike. Are there any sort of what we'd call key takeaways that you would flag up? Maybe 3 points that you've learnt about leadership during this extraordinary period?
Well, I think looking after yourself is so important if you're going to look after others. And I was talking to one of my team today. I'm very privileged to have a really great team. We were due to be having a quite businessy meeting, but we just talked about how each other were. And I think the ability for me to show some vulnerability, also giving permission to others to show some vulnerability, I think that is really important. The other part of that same conversation was about intentionality. What are the strategic guide rails for us that mean something not only at the top level, but at the middle levels, you know, so that people kind of got a sense of what we're going to be about if we're going to then emerge purposefully rather than just exhausted from this period.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess the conversation about us becoming a more caring and compassionate and better society as a result of what we've all gone through, but there may well be a flip side, which is that, you know, we're all going to go out and get roaring drunk and it'll be back to normal again and we'll be just as bad as we were before because it's all been pent up. Where do you fall on those two camps?
I think it'll be a bit of both. I think I'm looking forward to going up the hill to my local pub, so I'm having a pint. We keep being asked, partly actually by DCMS, where do you think we are in terms of volunteer availability for the next phase and beyond? It really is how long is a piece of string, because I think what's been shown through COVID is that volunteering is quite elastic, in fact, that when people have time and when there is a sense of urgency, people have, volunteering, mutual aid groups have really mushroomed. Then when people had less time, some of them returned to work or whatever it was, it contracted again. The important things, I'm having a lot of conversations again with peers about how we make it easier to volunteer. We're looking at a volunteer passport between St John Ambulance, Red Cross and Royal Voluntary Service as part of trying to make it easier for people to move between the organisations so they don't have to have a DBS check for each of the three organisations. They can move more easily between. And I think scouts and guides are looking at something similar. Well, then we might be able to connect up the passport we develop with scouts and guides. Trying to make it easier for people to offer their time is really important if we're to take advantage of this enhanced mutuality that has undoubtedly been unlocked during COVID and try to sustain that kindness.
Can I just make a comment on that? Because we've debated that, I think, back 3 years ago. I can remember when I was the chief exec of a local authority of trying to deal with the same thing with four different authorities at one stage, and them all saying, no, we've got to go through that test as well. How close are we to really making a difference with that, do you think?
Well, I think people are very seriously engaged with it.
Right.
We have a project underway with RVS and St John's to develop that passport,
right,
with the vision of having a prototype that we can use before next winter.
Great.
And that would be a great result, given that the founder of the British Red Cross, you know, came about from mobilising people 150 years ago plus. You know, that would be a fantastic modern legacy, I guess.
What, Alex, you touch on is that the Red Cross movement was the vision of someone called Henri Dunant on the battlefield of Solferino in 1859 and said, wouldn't it be amazing if in every country in the world there were volunteers ready to provide impartial, neutral help to anyone who needed it, whatever their ethnicity, religion or whatever. That's such a good idea. It caught on and we've become a large global movement. But at its heart, volunteerism is an essential part of it.
Just before we finish, Mike, I have to point out that only a couple of days before the recording of this podcast, there was something of a disaster in a small village not far from you in Gloucestershire, Winchcombe, with a large piece of moonrock landing in somebody's front driveway and causing everyone to talk about the possibility of asteroid attack. So I'm going to ask you, Mike, where do you think the next disaster is coming from?
Well, I carry around a copy of the National Risk Register with me,
yeah,
and asteroid attack and alien arrivals is not on it currently, yeah, but maybe it should
not
be.
Not yet. Watch this space.
Yeah.
If it does happen, I'm guessing you'll be there.
We certainly will be.
Yeah.
Mike, it's been great to have you on. We wish you well in the future and thank you for joining us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Mike Adamson from British Red Cross. Inspirational, I felt. What about you, Camilla?
Yeah, but also I loved his phrase about showing vulnerability, which gives permission to the whole of your organisation to do so. It isn't good enough anymore to stand up as if you know everything. And one of the things we know about this last year is we certainly don't know where we're going. But I had a sense that Mike is prepared for where we're going, even if he doesn't know where that is yet either.
I really liked when we were talking about what more the sector should be doing collectively to get the ear of government. He was talking about the need to be propositional and not oppositional, not to be shrill. And that very much goes back round to where we started our conversation this morning in terms of the use of superlatives and how one gets desensitized if the superlative is used too regularly.
Keith? Yeah, I think for me, he gave a lot of advice that other chief execs and chairs could take on board. He feels that they're going to have to reorganise going forward, but actually was committed to be open and honest, say, I think we can do things better. Mm. And that's a brilliant learning thing for me.
There's also a sense I felt that he'd had his eyes opened during this period.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And actually, even when he was talking about, you know, the reaction to the murder of George Floyd and their need to become more diverse in the way they're looking at things and as an organisation as well, seems always there slightly, you know, ahead of the game in terms of where everybody else is.
I think he's also, David, very matter of fact about some things. So, for example, this idea that volunteering is elastic.
Yeah.
So you have to have a volunteering system in place. But you also have to be accepting of the fact that people will volunteer more at certain times and when they can. I really liked the idea of the volunteer passport. I think this came up, I think, with Danny Kruger as well. If it can be achieved, then I think that matter of factness will stand him in good stead.
But what he was also saying, which was interesting to me, is that we're probably at the height of volunteering at the moment, because people have time on their hands. And I think if you look back at all the charities that at the moment maybe have a lot of people volunteering, they're going to have to think hard about how they're going to go through again when they come out of this.
Yeah. And I think that really underscores the importance of relationships and that mutual reliance that people have been seeing through volunteering. Margaret Heffernan, an author who recently spoke with us, talks about it's the mortar, not just the bricks, that make a building strong. In place of the mortar, it's this social capital, the trust and the reciprocity that we've really seen grown during this period.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Alex Scales.
More cracking episodes at goodcharitybadcharity.com. At GCBCpodcast is the Twitter handle. Dan Hardoon of Whistledown Productions is our producer. Thank you so much. Thank you to the Centre for Charity Effectiveness and to City Bridge Trust, without whom we just simply couldn't operate. That's Good Charity, Bad Charity. Till the next time. Goodbye.